Imagine standing in front of your bathroom mirror, like first thing in the morning.
Oh, that harsh fluorescent light.
Right, the light is just completely unforgiving. You lean in, and there it is, a new wrinkle.
Yep. Or a gray hair.
Exactly. Or maybe you notice your posture is changing, or, there's a new ache in your lower back. And instantly, I mean, instantly, this massive, incredibly loud narrative spins up in your head.
Look, it's so loud.
It really is. It's not just a simple observation about your biology anymore. Suddenly, it becomes this final ruling on your discipline or your fading youth, your attractiveness, or just, well, your fundamental worth.
Yeah. We treat our reflection as a daily report card on our value as human beings, which is,
It's exhausting.
it is. It's an immediate, almost reflexive leap, isn't it? We go straight from a purely physical observation to a profound moral or personal judgment.
It's completely binary, too. Like, we look good, so we feel like we are winning at life. We look tired or older, and suddenly we feel like we're failing. And today, we are going to explore a completely different way to look at that reflection. We are pulling our insights from a fascinating framework called the RAFT program, specifically from the RAFT to Freedom program.
Which is such an insightful
It
approach.
really is. And our mission today for this deep dive is to explore an ancient radical mental shift that can profoundly free you from compulsive and reactive behaviors that stem from how we view our physical selves.
And before we dive into the deep end, it really helps to know what we mean by RAFT. Because in the RAFT program, RAFT is actually an acronym.
Right, RAFT.
Exactly. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, Train. It is a highly structured, step-by-step approach to understanding our own minds and changing how we relate to the world around us.
And for this deep dive, we are camping out squarely in that very first phase.
The recognize phase.
Yes, specifically, we're focusing on chapter 12, which deals with something called the mindfulness of the reality of the body. Now, moving from that overarching framework into the actual practice, what does recognizing the reality of the body actually entail? Because I have to say, the way it is described in the RAFT program sounds honestly a bit intense.
Oh, it definitely can be jarring at first. I mean, the RAFT program draws heavily on the teachings of Gautama, the Buddha,
Right.
and in his teachings on the anchors of mindfulness, Gautama invited practitioners to undertake a very specific contemplation. Rather than looking at the body as a whole, solid entity, this cohesive
Like
unit.
the way we usually see ourselves in the mirror.
Exactly. Instead of that, he suggested reviewing the body systematically from the soles of the feet all the way up to the crown of the head. But you don't do this in a vague, general way. You are meant to examine its 32 specific parts.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because we are talking about actively visualizing hair, nails, skin, flesh, bones, organs, and fluids.
Yes, the messy stuff.
Totally. And the RAFT program uses an analogy here that I find really striking. They say it's like taking a bag of mixed grain, untying the string, and just, well, naming what you find inside.
Right, you open the bag and say, ah, here's some rice, here's some lentils, here's some wheat.
But applied to human anatomy. So you are sitting there saying, here is a kidney, here is some phlegm, here is some bone marrow, here is bile. And I have to admit, when I first read this, I balked.
Why is that? What was the resistance there?
Because, and if you're listening to this right now, you might have the exact same thought I did. Isn't focusing on things like the spleen, phlegm, and intestines just going to cultivate total disgust?
I see.
I mean, we already have such a complicated, often painful relationship with our physical forms. If I sit around meditating on my bile, doesn't that just breed an intense shame or aversion towards my own body?
What was fascinating here is that the intended outcome is the exact opposite of shame or disgust.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you're right. If the goal was to make you hate your body, that would be incredibly unskillful. It just add a whole new layer of pain and disappointment to what is already a very fraught relationship for most people.
Right, making it worse.
Exactly. Hating the body doesn't liberate you. It just makes the experience of living in it absolutely miserable.
Yeah, totally. So, what is the actual mechanism here then? Why are we mentally dissecting ourselves?
The goal is to loosen a very specific, very exhausting tug of war that constantly plays out in our minds. Picture a rope. On one side of this rope, you have our vanity and our idealization of appearance.
Like the obsession with looking young, fit, glowing, and flawless.
Precisely. We treat the body like an ornament that constantly needs polishing. But then on the other side of the rope, pulling in the opposite direction, you have our dislike, our shame, and our aversion when the body inevitably fails to meet those impossible standards.
Oh, wow. It's a swinging pendulum. We're either worshiping the body when it cooperates and looks great in a photograph, or we're utterly despising it when we get sick, or gain weight, or just age.
Yes, exactly. And this specific contemplation, breaking the body down into its 32 messy biological components, it stops the pendulum dead in its tracks.
Because you can't really idealize a kidney.
Exactly. When the body is seen clearly, part by part, it becomes undeniable that it is neither an ornament to be worshipped nor an enemy to be despised.
Yeah.
It is simply what it is. It is bone, it is skin, it is blood.
You know, it's like how we treat a brand new smartphone.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, when you first buy it, you are obsessed with the shiny exterior. You wipe every smudge off the glass. You buy a pristine case. And if you drop it and get a tiny millimeter scratch on the side, your heart sinks.
Your whole day is ruined because your shiny ornament is flawed.
Right. But imagine if instead of staring at the glass, you took off the back panel. You look inside and you see the lithium battery, the copper wires, the microchips, the green motherboard. Suddenly, the illusion breaks.
You realize what it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. You realize, oh, this isn't a magical piece of jewelry. It's just a machine designed to transmit signals. And once you see the wiring, you stop obsessing over a microscopic scratch on the case because you realize the external shell isn't the point.
That is a brilliant way to look at it. You stop identifying with the casing and you simply acknowledge the hardware.
Exactly. But this brings us to an important application. Because, well, we aren't just sitting on meditation cushions all day. We have to live in society.
Right. We have lives to lead.
So how does acknowledging our internal hardware actually change our behavior out in the real world?
Well, to understand the why behind this practice, the RAF program points back to Gautama's first realization.
Which is?
The acknowledgement that life is naturally painful, difficult, and disappointing.
Wow. Which can sound quite stark to modern ears, honestly.
It can. Mm. But it's not pessimism.
Yeah.
It's a deep, grounding realism. When you contemplate your physical makeup in this detailed, granular way, you bring that truth directly into your moment-to-moment physical experience. When you look at the body as a collection of parts that are subject to constant wear and tear, things like aging, illness, and mortality, stop being these abstract, terrifying fears hovering in the future. Mm-hmm. They become shared, ordinary realities.
I really want to emphasize that phrase, shared, ordinary realities, because mm-hmm. normally when I find a gray hair or a new ache, I feel singled out. I feel like something is going wrong with me specifically.
Oh, yeah, we all do that. It feels deeply personal.
Right. But this practice connects us. You are made of parts. I am made of parts. Everyone we pass on the street is carrying around the same bag of grain.
Yeah, exactly.
But how does this translate to stopping those compulsive and reactive behaviors? Because when we feel uncomfortable physically or emotionally, our default mode is to escape, right?
Absolutely.
Like we overeat, we doom scroll, we chase adrenaline, we exhaust ourselves at the gym. We try to manipulate our physical state to find some kind of lasting comfort.
Yes, and that is a fundamental trap. We mistakenly believe that if we can just manipulate the body's sensations perfectly, if we can just eat the right thing or look a certain way or numb the pain enough, we will find permanent peace.
Right.
But the body is in a state of constant flux. You cannot freeze it in a state of perfect comfort.
And this is where the deconstruction helps. By seeing the body as a temporary, constantly changing collection of parts, we weaken the pull to fall overboard into old reactive patterns.
Precisely.
We stop trying to use the body as a tool for permanent salvation. We finally realize it can never be a source of lasting satisfaction because, well, it is physically impossible for a bag of changing parts to stay exactly the way we want it to.
And that realization is profoundly liberating. By gently facing these uncomfortable aspects of our physical reality, the fluids, the organs, the impermanence, we are actively building our mental capacity.
Like a muscle.
Exactly. We are training our minds to sit with discomfort without needing to escape it immediately.
So we don't have to instantly hit the panic button when we feel a pang of physical or emotional discomfort. Mm. We can just say, oh, the stomach is experiencing acidity or the nervous system is activated instead of my life is falling apart and I need to fix it right this second.
Exactly. Because when you fixate on appearance or on avoiding discomfort, that fixation becomes a massive trigger for reactivity.
Right.
This contemplation shifts your attention completely inward. You stop relying on outward validation, and instead you cultivate a calm, objective self-compassion for the inner workings of this complex machine that carries you around.
Now, this all makes perfect sense conceptually. It's a complete paradigm shift. But how does a 2,500-year-old teaching hold up in a modern scientific context?
Well, beautifully.
I mean, if someone is sitting in a modern therapist's office struggling with body image issues, does this framework actually map onto our current understanding of the brain?
The science is actually remarkably supportive of this exact practice.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the RAFT program dives into the neuroscience behind this shift. Mm-hmm.
When we have a distorted body image, when we are caught in that endless tug of war of vanity and shame, it is physically linked to altered activity in specific brain networks. Specifically, we are talking about the insula and the medial prefrontal cortex.
Right, let's break those down for a second. The insula is a region deep inside the brain that is deeply involved in interoception.
Interoception?
Yes, interoception is our ability to perceive sensations inside our body. So things like feeling your heartbeat, sensing your digestion, or knowing when your lungs are expanding.
Okay, so the insula is essentially the raw data center.
Exactly. Now, the medial prefrontal cortex, on the other hand, is heavily involved in self-referential thoughts. It's a key part of the default mode network.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it drains the narrator in your head. It drains the part of the brain that says, I look tired today, everyone is going to judge me, I'm losing my edge.
Wow. So when we are obsessing over the mirror, the medial prefrontal cortex is working overtime. The narrator is just screaming at us.
Yes, exactly. But what the research highlights is that contemplating impermanence, doing this exact practice of breaking the body down into its 32 biological parts, forces a shift. You are literally building your interoceptive awareness.
Right. You are forcing the brain to process raw data in the insula, which naturally quiets the noisy narrator in the medial prefrontal cortex.
So you are basically starving the ego of attention and feeding the raw sensory centers.
Exactly. By feeling your body from the inside out rather than judging it from the outside in, you physically train the brain to stop taking the body's appearance so personally.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just the neuroscience that is backing this up, right? It spans across psychology and philosophy as well.
Oh, absolutely.
In modern psychotherapy, there is this well-established mechanism of exposure and acceptance. If you gently and mindfully face an uncomfortable truth, like the fact that you are made of flesh and bone that will eventually decay, and you do it in a safe context, you reduce your reactivity to it over time.
It has the acceptance component that is key there. You aren't just exposing yourself to the thought. You are accepting the reality of it without struggling against it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When people experience intense body-focused distress, cultivating this realistic, non-judgmental awareness is incredibly effective. You literally stop fighting the reality of your biology.
And philosophically, it is like a masterclass in several major schools of thought all at once. The RAFT program points out that this mirrors Stoicism beautifully.
Yes. I mean, think about how a Stoic views a new gray hair compared to how modern society views it.
Right. Modern culture treats aging as a tragedy, you know, a loss of value that needs to be fought with expensive creams and procedures.
But a Stoic looks at that gray hair and sees the natural order. They meet aging and mortality with equanimity, recognizing that this is simply the contract we sign by being born.
It also resonates deeply with existentialism, too.
It does.
Because existentialism takes the undeniable reality of our finite, embodied existence as the starting point for meaning. Think about it. If our bodies were indestructible and lasted forever, time would be completely meaningless.
You would never have to prioritize anything.
Exactly. It is the very fragility and limits of the body that give our time its value.
And of course, weaving all of this together is the Buddhist concept of dukkha, this fundamental understanding that attachment causes pain and disappointment.
Right, the suffering.
Yeah. When we attach our sense of ultimate self-worth to something as fragile and impermanent as physical beauty or even physical health, we are guaranteeing our own suffering.
Because those things will absolutely undeniably change.
Right. You are essentially building your house on quicksand and then acting surprised when it sinks.
Okay, but I do have to push back here for a second because this raises an incredibly practical question. If we deconstruct the body intellectually, scientifically, and philosophically, if we view it merely as a temporary collection of 32 parts subject to decay, how do we avoid just giving up?
You mean falling into neglect or nihilism?
Exactly. So what does this all mean for our Tuesday mornings? I mean, we clearly shouldn't just neglect the body. We can't just say, well, I'm just a bag of bones and bile, so who cares if I eat junk food and never sleep?
Right, right.
How do we find the middle ground between obsession and total neglect?
This is where the core analogy of the RAFT program provides perfect clarity. The program asks you to imagine that this practice is like examining the material your actual raft is made of.
Okay.
You look closely at the logs, the vines, the structure holding it together, and you see that it is totally ordinary material. It is subject to wear, it is subject to the weather, and it will eventually degrade. It is not an eternally solid magical vessel.
But, and this is the crucial part of the analogy. You absolutely need that raft to make your journey. You are trying to navigate across a river to a safe shore.
Yes.
If you let the raft rot away from neglect, you are going to sink.
Exactly. You must maintain the raft. You must care for it diligently. But you don't obsess over its appearance. You don't spend precious hours polishing the logs or painting racing stripes on the side of the raft while you were in the middle of navigating treacherous rapids.
No.
You appreciate its function without fixating on its form.
Function over form. I love that.
Yeah.
It takes all the neuroticism out of self-care. It becomes balanced maintenance, not an identity project.
That's a great way to put it.
And the RAFT program outlines three very specific, very ordinary practices to care for the body. Because just having a vague intention to, like, care for yourself is too easy to agree with and then completely ignore. We need actionable specifics.
We do. And the first of those three practices is mindful eating.
Which, let's be honest, is so much harder than it sounds.
Oh, definitely.
Mindful eating isn't just about counting macros. It means paying actual attention to the experience of eating and noticing its effect on the physical body and the mind. It means stepping out of autopilot.
Right. Instead of eating to numb an emotion or eating just because the clock says noon, we are eating intentionally to fuel the raft. We are observing how the engine responds to the fuel.
And the second practice is moving meditation. And this is important. This doesn't necessarily mean an intense punishing workout where you are judging yourself in the gym mirrors.
No, not at all. It means integrating mindful movement into your day.
Right. It could be a short walking meditation, some gentle yoga or Qigong. It's a moving the body intentionally to maintain its mechanical function rather than treating movement as the separate dreaded obligation to burn calories or sculpt a certain aesthetic.
Yes. It is movement as maintenance, not movement as punishment.
And the third practice is sleep hygiene. The RAFT program emphasizes having a consistent sleep schedule and a proper wind-down routine.
Which is so critical. This isn't just about resting the muscles either. It's about securing the mental clarity that this entire mindfulness practice depends on.
Right.
If your raft is completely exhausted, the person steering it cannot navigate the waters safely.
Without sleep, the medial prefrontal cortex, that noisy narrator we talked about, just completely takes over, and you lose all that interoceptive awareness.
Exactly.
These three practices, eating, moving, sleeping when done mindfully, support the steadiness of mind that the whole journey relies on. They are acts of profound respect for the vehicle you are traveling in without worshiping it.
It really fosters a sense of ordinary gratitude. You know, you are simply grateful. The heart keeps pumping. The lungs keep expanding. The legs keep walking.
Yeah.
You begin relating to this physical form with less craving, less resistance, and much more appreciation for what it actually achieves every single day.
And that shifting perspective is what ultimately frees you. You stop desperately defending a fixed idea of how you should look, and you actually start living your life. You step off the pendulum.
It opens up so much mental space that used to be occupied by anxiety and management.
It truly is a profound shift. Now, as we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to make sure you know exactly where all these incredible insights are coming from.
Yes.
The framework, the analogies, and the concepts we've explored today come directly from the RAFT to Freedom workbook. This workbook is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen. And what is truly remarkable is that they are making the entire 66-chapter program completely freely available online for anyone who wants to explore it.
It really is a tremendous, generous resource.
It is. You can find all of this material by visiting their website at raft2freedom.org.
And in the spirit of that program, as requested by the authors, I would like to invite you to take a brief moment of self-reflection right now. This draws directly from the program's own exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Just take a breath, soften your gaze, and gently ask yourself, what would it feel like to care for your body without needing it to look a certain way? When you think of your body as simply a collection of parts and processes, rather than a fixed you to defend or perfect, how does that shift feel?
Just sit with that for a moment. Feel the space that opens up in your mind when you finally let go of the mirror. And to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over, I want to share the exact closing quote from this chapter of the RAFT program, spoken by Andrea Fella. You just break the body apart in this way, and it becomes clear, yes, it's just a collection of parts,